ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What happens when wills go wrong? Contested documents, undue influence, farming family fallouts, and executors left to sort out the mess. Hi, Damien Carrick here. Over the next few weeks, the Law Report presents Over My Dead Body, a special series on wills and succession.
Mr. Chenery wrote his will on a frozen fish packet and a packet of Mr. Kipling's mince pies.
People who are a little bit unhinged have appointed senior politicians and public figures to be their executors, people who they've no connection with.
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it. These things happen behind closed doors.
If you own property, if you own an asset, the general rule is you can do whatever you want in terms of who you leave it to. You don't have to be fair, you don't have to be equal.
You want to write a will. You want to make sure that your assets will go to those you think deserve your generosity. So how can you make sure your will is binding? Does it need to be a formal document printed out and signed with a pen? Or in 2026, can a valid will be a Word document, an email, a text? Can it be written on a frozen fish packet? Today on Over My Dead Body, we're looking at how courts decide whether a will is or isn't valid. A warning, this conversation makes multiple references to suicide, so take care when listening. And it also doesn't represent or replace legal advice. Professor Prue Vines from the University of New South Wales is an expert in wills. Prue, what are the legal formalities for writing a binding will?
Oh, well, they're fairly straightforward. They are that the will needs to be in writing, it needs to be signed by the testator, and while the testator is signing, the two witnesses who will sign get to see the testator writing, and they both need to be present at the same time.
Recently in the UK, the will of a Mr. Malcolm Chenery came before the courts. It complied with these requirements, but Prue, it certainly wasn't what you describe as conventional or formal.
I would really like to know a great deal more about why he chose what he did. Mr. Chenery wrote his will on a frozen fish packet, Young's Fish, and a packet of Mr. Kipling's mince pies.
This was a serious estate. It included a three-bedroom house, jewellery collection, cash and a pottery collection. Who did he leave all of this to?
He left it to Diabetes UK. So I don't know whether there's any connection between frozen fish and mince pie packaging and Diabetes UK. I suspect not. But the thing was that the court looked at what had been done. So the requirement is writing and the signatures of the testator and the witnesses. And all those things were there. So although it was on a strange piece of packaging or a strange piece of paper, it still met the requirements. So the court was happy to allow it.
And this, you know, two-page will was witnessed by his neighbours, is that right?
Yes. So actually, the requirements that I said before, writing, signed by the testator in the presence of two witnesses, all those were met.
And the High Court had to decide whether to grant probate in this case. I think his family actually supported the will, saying that diabetes, you know, ran in the family. So they weren't opposing this.
So they weren't really opposing it. But the technicalities had actually been met in that case.
Does that surprise you, that decision?
Not particularly. As a stickler for the proprieties, the UK is particularly strong. So once they got over the surprise of the frozen fish and mince pie packaging, I think they could see that the normal requirements had been met.
In this case, Malcolm Chenery died in 2021. He ended his own life. His will was written on the back of frozen fish packaging and also the back of frozen mince pies packaging. Have there been other food packaging cases?
I remember one case really well where a person wrote their will in quite a lot of detail, dividing up the estate into shares on the back of the cornflakes packet, and that was admitted. The court really didn't have much trouble with that. The surrounding circumstances showed that that's what they want, and they handed it over and said that's what they wanted. There was another one that was written on a hospital menu card where the person wrote it on the card, and it was assisted by the fact that they said to their friend, here, this is what I want in my will. Can you make it happen? So that was also allowable. I think people sometimes just use the nearest napkin or whatever, especially if they suddenly realise that they do really have to finalise things for other people. And so that's when you get the cornflakes packet or the fish packet or being looked at.
There was a very tragic case in Canada involving a farmer and a tractor fender. This was a unique and terrible case. This will was found to comply with Canadian law.
This was very sad. He was driving his tractor and he rolled it and it rolled onto him. So it killed him, but not immediately. He had time to write what he wanted done on the tractor fender, scratched it into the tractor fender, and that was allowed. Now, the reason that that was allowed was really quite different from the others. He was in Quebec or one of the other couple of Canadian states which are basically derived their law from civil law, like European law.
Provinces.
Yeah, one of their provinces, sorry, that allowed a holograph will. So a holograph will is very common in European countries where they use civil law. And in those wills, as the testator, you have to have written every part of the will in your own handwriting. And he had done that. So he had written it all and signed it, and that was sufficient to make it a holograph will.
What about here in Australia? There's a really interesting case involving the estate of a Mr. Slavinsky.
That was after we brought in the dispensing power. So we'll explain that in a minute. But in that case, Mr. Slavinsky was very ill, dying. He wrote his will on the gyprock wall next to his bed. So he could sign it. He wrote it all there. That was allowed. The big question there really was, what do we do about the wall? Do we have to cut out a piece of the gyprock and take that to court, or can we take a photograph? And the court allowed the photograph.
The court allowed the photograph. This is a case, the testator wrote out his will in Ukrainian on the gyprock wall, stating, to my nieces in the USSR and the name and address of one niece together with the name and address of another niece. And I think there was also an envelope with his niece's names on it that he placed in a crack in this plasterboard wall. And the envelope together with a photo of the wall was admitted to probate, and that the court ticked the box and granted probate.
Yeah.
So here in Australia, we have something called the dispensing power that allows courts to say, right, even if you don't fill the formal requirements, we'll still look at the big picture to see what the intentions of the testator were.
This came in Australia in about 1978, first in South Australia and then gradually around the other jurisdictions. So what they did was give the court a power to look at the will and to decide whether it amounted to a document that included things like marks, symbols or perforations having a meaning for people qualified to interpret them, or anything from which sounds, images or writings can be reproduced with or without the aid of another article or device. So that was a sudden broadening of what could be allowed. But the critical thing was that the court had to be satisfied that when the testator made that will, he or she really did intend that document to operate as their final disposition. And that question of finality turned out to be one of the most critical issues in this area.
So for many years now, if it now had this dispensing power, this, you look at the big picture, all the unconventional wills we've been talking about so far are physical documents. But of course, Prue, we live in the digital age and people create wills on their computers, on their mobiles. Tell me about the case of Nickel and Nickel.
What happened in that case was that Mr. Nickel decided he was going to commit suicide, and he wrote out his will and so on his mobile phone.
And Mr. Nickel is a Queensland truck driver, age 55, who had been married to a lady called Julie Nickel, but it was a bumpy marriage, yeah.
The thing here is that normally if you write a text message to somebody, when you send it, that's when it's final, right? But in this case, he didn't send it. And the reason he didn't send it was that he didn't want the people he would send it to come and stop him committing suicide. So then they had to go into this question of could it still be regarded as his final disposition? Did he really mean that document without anything else to happen to operate as his will? And the court decided that it did, because in that he had mentioned who he wanted to get all the things in his estate and said that he was, you know, it was clear that he was going to die and so on. That meant it met all the requirements of the dispensing power.
He addresses the text to his brother David, the text that he doesn't send. But in this text, it's quite detailed. It says, I want to leave all my assets to my brother David and to my nephew Jack, David's son. And it included a list of all his assets, a PIN number to his bank account, and also very clear instructions about what to do with his ashes. But yes, he doesn't send the text. And then he ends his life, this was in October 2016, and then his wife, Julie, contests the will, saying that he died intestate and she should be appointed.
So she should get the benefit.
That's right, she should get the benefit. But the Queensland Court upheld the validity of this unsent text. Why did they do that?
Well, they went through all the detail of the material that he had put into that text, and it clearly showed that he was determined that these things would go to his brother and so on. So those details that you've mentioned were really important to get a sense of his level of finality. And the explanation for why he didn't press send was really clear. He didn't want his brother to immediately come and try and stop him. The detail and so on that was in that document itself was pretty convincing that this was intended. It was, you know, relatively formal. He signed it. He did all the things, apart from pressing the button, that would have shown that it was final. So the court was happy to see that as final.
He wrote out the text and then what, typed out his name at the bottom as a signature.
Yeah, he did all that, yeah.
So there was also the case of Sydney restaurateur David Yazbek. What form did his will take?
He typed out his will on his computer, but he didn't do anything else. So there was nothing that had been separately signed or witnessed or anything. He appears not to have printed it. So the question of finality was more difficult than it was, say, in the Nickel case. Eventually the court felt that it was admissible to probate and that he hadn't done anything after he wrote that indicated that he wanted to revoke it. So they accepted it as demonstrating his final intention.
Interesting. So back in 2009, he creates this document on his desktop computer. I think he creates it over a period of days. Then he goes on an overseas holiday and tells his colleague that in case anything happens to him, it's sitting there on the computer, on the hard drive. Nothing happens. 14 months later, he ends his life and this document is found on his computer. And what, the court is satisfied that this formed a valid will?
So one of the things to keep in mind here is that the dispensing power also applies to the revocation of wills. So it's not just the making, but it's also you can revoke it using the dispensing power. So one of the things they had to look at was whether there was any evidence that in that 14 months he had wanted to revoke the will. If you've got a will in writing, you can tear it up and that will revoke it. You can do things to it. But with a document that's on a computer, you could delete it and that would have indicated revocation. But he hadn't done that and he told other people about it. So that seems to have been enough for the court to think that he hadn't changed his mind and so the will was admissible to probate.
There was also the case of a young Queensland man who travelled to Canberra for work, and this was a case from 2013 and he ended his life in a hotel room. What form did his will take?
Well, he created a whole series of documents on his iPhone. So one said it was his last will, on which he typed his name as a signature, he put his address, you know, that was all very detailed. But it was also accompanied by a whole lot of other things that were sort of finishing things off, saying goodbye, things like that. So there was actually a whole suite of documents around the will itself that showed that he really did intend it to be his final will.
And he writes his will on the notes application on his smartphone. I think he appoints his brother as executor and the brother asks the Queensland Supreme Court for probate. Again, yeah, he ends his life very shortly after he does this.
Yeah.
What was very interesting about that case is that they were looking at the electronic timestamps of when these documents were made and also when the hotel room was accessed. Why was that important?
Well, first of all, there's the question of whether somebody's interfered. Because if we know the time sequence that these things happen in, we would get a better sense if he'd changed his mind or he'd sort of gone off on a different trajectory or something. So he didn't do anything like that. So that meant that he had this set over a relatively significant period of documents that were sort of consistent.
Because of the electronic swipe card hotel room access, it was clear that no one had entered the room between the time that this document was created and him passing.
And that's a really great benefit, in fact, because one of the big problems with electronic documents and things is how do we know whether that person did it? You know, anyone can sit in front of my computer and send off my emails if it's there and I've already got the password in and all that. So in this case, they knew he'd gone into the room. They had the electronic signature showing and that nobody else came in. So there was no suggestion that anybody else was influencing him either. And that's really important with this electronic stuff.
There must be a lot of cases these days where testators video themselves, either using a video camera or in this day and age, a smartphone. Presumably those are upheld as valid wills normally?
They usually are, but we still sort of take the same concerns. You know, we want to make sure there's nobody else influencing it and so on. But in New South Wales, in Wei Fun Chan, she made her video using her smartphone and she just videoed herself saying what she wanted and so on, including chastising her children. And again, the court was satisfied with that, that it was a continuous process and so on. So if we look at a document that's written and the people who sign it in different pens, that might raise the possibility that something's interfered with the normal process. And the same way with a video or something, we want to be sure that the video is videoing the person. Usually we want to see a bit of the surroundings to help us be sure that there's no undue influence or anything in place.
No one's kind of whispering in somebody's ear. And in this case, Wei Fun Chan, she created a will dividing her assets to her eight children. It was witnessed by two independent witnesses. But 2 days later, she decides to leave more to the two children who'd taken care of her for the last 20 years. She kind of had a good hard think about what she'd just done. So she creates this recording in her kitchen and it is upheld. The court said, look, she's calm, she's measured. There's lots of other evidence that this constitutes her final wishes.
Yes, that's right,
There was also a case of a will, and it was a written document, a handwritten document, but it was written in a very unusual form. It was written in the form of a poem. Tell me about the case of Costa.
Costa committed suicide after making a will, which he wrote in a sort of a form of a poem with the words sort of spread down the page. And it basically said, "Mum and Dad, I think I'm dying. Please look after all my good writing." He kept a lot of stuff that he wrote and he called that his good writing and it was kept in a special place. He said, "There might be some more in the drawer. Take care of them. I want you to have my house." So it was fairly comprehensive and there's no reason to think a poem is a problem. There were actually many wills over the centuries that were done in poetic form. So the court was happy enough to grant probate to that one.
And I think he had separated from his wife and moved back into his parents' house and was concerned about their financial well-being.
Yes.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National, a special four-part series, Over My Dead Body, where we're looking at what can go wrong with wills. I'm speaking with Professor Prue Vines about unconventional wills. Look, I've got to ask, Prue, a lot of these cases we're talking about involve people who've ended their life, and sometimes very shortly after, you know, making this final informal will. How does that decision to end their life mesh in with the idea, because they're presumably in distress, perhaps don't have a clear mind, perhaps are unwell, mentally unwell. How does that mesh in with the idea that they did or didn't have capacity?
There's good authority of a good 30 years or so, that the mere fact of deciding to commit suicide is not to be taken as a sign of lost capacity. So they will still look at, you know, when you're looking at an informal will, you still need to have capacity. The main difference is that with an informal will, there's no presumption of capacity the way there is with a formal will. So that makes a difference. So they will be looking at the surrounding circumstances, the evidence of whether the person was clear-minded or not. As you said, in Wei Fun Chan, they thought she was clearly calm and clearly thinking. They were happy to find that she had capacity.
That wasn't a suicide case, I should add.
Yep. No, that wasn't a suicide case, but they still had to establish her capacity. So this is one thing that I think people need to be fairly clear about. Capacity in the common law generally is transactional. You don't have to have general capacity. You have to have capacity to do that particular transaction. So you have to know what a will is. You have to understand what a will does. You have to understand what property you have. And you don't have to know that in enormous detail. You don't need to know the numbers of your shares or things like that. And you need to know who are the people that would be likely to have a moral claim on you. That is what testamentary capacity is. So one thing to keep in mind here is that just because somebody has early dementia, for example, won't mean they don't have any testamentary capacity necessarily.
There have also been interesting cases involving hospital clinical notes. What have been some of those?
One of them is Newman, where there were handwritten notes on one page of the printed form of progress notes.
You mean clinical notes, hospital?
Yeah, the clinical notes that you have at the bottom of your bed in the hospital. So the testator wrote to his lawyer saying, "I wish you to make the following changes to my current will." And then he signed by the deceased. And then he got the physio to sign underneath. Then a nurse came along and said to the physio, "Staff aren't allowed to sign those documents." And she crossed out the physio's signature. And then she said to the physio, "This is what I find mystifying, sign where I've crossed out." So the physio signed again and the nurse took the document away and it eventually got to the lawyers. That was one of the ones that, again, that was regarded as sensible. He knew what he wanted. He signed it. He did formal thing like asking someone to sign for him. And that was regarded as a document that could be admitted to probate.
I understand he wrote, after he'd signed the document, quote, "My mind is strong and I know what I'm doing here. Now please place this with my medical records," end of quote.
Yes, that's right.
So
he'd done a lot of things to make sure it happened. And those are the things that we're really looking for in a document like this.
Prue, what are online wills and have there been any court cases around them?
There are several platforms that are offering online wills where you go into their platform, you answer questions, which they then use to put a will together for you, or you write the will yourself, and they usually offer someone to sort of check it over and then make the will and then you can sign it or do that electronically. So there was one case in the Rita Riemann case in 2022, and again, this is a suicide. This was one with a draft will questionnaire. So she did the draft will questionnaire online.
So she pays her money and she fills out a questionnaire.
You don't pay your money until you've done the questionnaire, I think. Mm. So she did that. She paid the money. She then wrote to her solicitor and said, "I have drawn up and completed a will," sent him the link to the online questionnaire, and then committed suicide. Now, an extra little complication was that because it was a public holiday, the providers hadn't actually made the will because they didn't do it till the next day, and they were notified of her death before they could make the will. So they didn't actually generate a will for her.
So we just have a series of answers to a series of questions designed to form the basis of a will.
Yes, okay. That's right.
Yeah, right. So what happened?
The judge looked at all these things. He said there was a clear sequence of finalising her affairs before her suicide. She wrote to a few other people as well, but the writing to the solicitor was clearly very significant, and he allowed it. He said, that's okay. He was satisfied that she really did intend that to operate as her will.
I think she'd also sent a text to her sister referring to the will she had made that morning and says she had emailed it to her lawyer and she didn't have time to wait until it was signed but hoped it would stick. And the court was quite comfortably satisfied that she intends this to operate as her will.
Yeah. My big concern about these is always, how do we know that that person actually did it? To me, will kits are always something to be a bit concerned about. And that applies even to the, you know, the post office wills, the written ones. Lots of trouble came out of that. I always say to my students, why do you think lawyers haven't tried to stop these wills? Because it seems to me that they generate an awful lot of work for lawyers. You know, because you get this, even with a written will, there are some printed bits that are supposed to be part of the will. You don't know whether that person intended that printed bit to be their will or not. There are all sorts of things. So it's a bit tricky using a will kit, even though it does help you to, you know, they tell you what to do and to do it. But because of the one-size-fits-all thing, it's a bit difficult.
But with both the paper will kits and the online will kits, once it's done, once the document is compiled, doesn't it then have to be witnessed?
Yes, it does have to be witnessed. But if we use the dispensing power, we may have external evidence that tells us these things that I'm worried about.
So, Prue, big picture, should we keep these formalities and should we adhere to them strictly, or should we be a bit flexible? Should we loosen things up a bit? What do you think?
So I'm quite comfortable with the dispensing power as it has operated in Australia. I think they have been fairly good at working out who's really intended this to be their document or not. I mean, most of the informal wills we get, our person's done their best to sign it, they've got one witness and there isn't one or something. Well, that's really not very material. So I wonder whether we could reduce our formal requirements a little more. You know, only one witness might be enough. But I'm fairly comfortable with having the dispensing power and with the scrutiny that's given to those wills. But of course, the best thing is always to make the will meet the formalities so that when it goes into the probate court, the probate office, the registrar looks at it and goes, totally normal, lets it go straight through, and there is absolutely no discussion about it. That's what you want.
That's a take-home message from this conversation. We've been talking about some fascinating cases, but you really don't want your will to be subject of a discussion like this. You want it just to go through quickly and efficiently through the courts.
That is absolutely right. Look, the real point of making wills is to make life for those left behind easier. And although there is often a lot of discussion about how there's increasing disputes and so on, I don't think it's an increase as a rate of the population. And the truth is that most of our formal wills and things go through very smoothly. There are not any arguments about it, and everybody can just carry on. So that means that the system, while it's wobbly at the edges, is sort of basically sound.
University of New South Wales Professor Prue Vines, an expert in wills. Thank you. Thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
My pleasure.
Next time, farming family fallouts over a will.
An equal share is a very easy mathematical decision to make, but it can mean the loss of the farm from the family in the long term over the generations.
Wills disputes over farming properties. That's on the next episode of Over My Dead Body, a four-part series on The Law Report. Do follow The Law Report on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. It's also where you'll find the full series of Over My Dead Body and where you can follow Radio National's weekly fix of legal news. We look at the big cases like the Corey Richens poisoning case. Is she America's Erin Patterson? Why was Australian soldier Ben Robert Smith granted bail on war crimes charges? And we also delve into cutting-edge legal issues like facial recognition, voluntary assisted dying, who's liable for a bushfire? And what sorts of laws do we need to tackle cults? A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and audio producer Elise Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.